different now. She felt different. "I'm not sorry he's here," she informed Diana. "I think I might be okay about it." Lenny K162. Talked to B, finally. Cannot believe about Eric. Carmabel. Cannot either. She said she's okay, though. Lenny K162. Do we believe her? Do we go to Pennsylvania and drag her home? Carmabel. Let's give it a week. Today was the day Valia had her doctor's appointment. Her kidneys had apparently been doing something funky, so she was supposed to get something or other checked once every 2 weeks at the hospital. It was their first outing, and Carmen welcomed it. Just leaving the house had to be good. Even if they both got squashed by a bulldozer on their first step down the front walk, it would be preferable to another long afternoon spent in the darkened Caligari's den. Besides, today was also the day Carmen got to wear the traveling pants, and nothing magical was going to happen sitting inside with Valia close enough to squash it. They'd only been together for 1 week, and already Carmen and Valia were in a rut. After madly IMing and yelling at the computer, and at Carmen, for a couple of hours, while also listening to the TV, Valia's energy would start to fade. Sometime around 3 o'clock, she would change to a soft chair, and her head would start to nod and swerve as sleep tried to claim her. This was around the time that Brawn and Beauty came on. Carmen would perch at the edge of her chair and gingerly, slowly reach for the remote control. Then, waiting long minutes if necessary, she would watch for Valia's wrinkly lids to shut. Then she would wait even longer. Then, slowly, she would shift down the volume and slowly scroll through the channels. Her heart would be in her throat at this point. Once she got to Channel 4, she would imagine victory at hand. She would yearn for that first look at Ryan Hennessy's turquoise eyes, and then Valia would shoot straight up in her chair and bellow, "That is not my show!" And Carmen, in pitiful defeat, would turn back to Valia's show, and then the cycle would start again. So Carmen was shamefully grateful to Valia's misfiring kidneys as she and Valia shut themselves into Carmen's car. She was deaf to Valia's 10-minute harangue about how Carmen didn't hold the steering wheel right. They were absurdly early for the appointment, thanks to Carmen's eagerness, so Carmen was the picture of flexibility when Valia insisted they stop at the ice cream shop around the corner from the hospital. Who was Carmen to turn down ice cream? Valia wanted pistachio. No, she didn't. She wanted butter pecan. No, that would not be good. "Why do they have the cookies in the ice cream?" she demanded to know. "What do they mean by these jimmies? Who would eat that purple thing?" Carmen saw the look on the face of the girl behind the counter, and it was familiar. It was a look that she imagined she herself had worn for roughly 30 hours the week before. Finally, after an excruciating number of questions and unsolicited criticisms, Valia settled on peppermint ice cream, of all things. It was a garish red and slimy-looking. Valia took one bite and shoved it toward Carmen.
"I hate it. You eat it."
"I don't want it."
"I hate it."
Valia kept pushing it at her. Carmen was fuming. She hated Valia's nasty peppermint ice cream, too. And furthermore, she hated Valia. Valia was a big, fat baby. Carmen hated babies. She hated old people. She hated everyone in between. She hated everyone. Except him. He was a guy, maybe her age or a little older, who walked into the store just as Carmen was dodging the slimy red ice cream. She didn't hate him, though at her rate, perhaps she could learn to. He wasn't Ryan Hennessy or anything, but some quality about him struck her nonetheless. His straight hair was yellowish-brown and a little bit unkempt. His eyebrows were almost blonde, and his freckles made him look kind of jaunty, like he didn't care about anything too much. His eyes, on the other hand, made him look like he did. She looked at his face for a moment too long. When she turned her head back, she saw the scoop of ice cream bobbling on Valia's cone, and it was too late to fix it. Sure enough, the scoop plunged to the ground and skidded a foot or so. Valia, incensed, shouted something at Carmen in Greek and then made a show of striding away. But the peppermint ice cream didn't just look slimy. Valia's heel hit the trail of ice cream, and Carmen watched in horror as the old lady went down hard. Carmen's shout and Valia's scream mingled and merged in the air. Almost instantly, Carmen had Valia in her arms. Valia was lighter and drier than she would have imagined. Her eyes were squeezed shut, and her face was twisted in pain. Carmen could tell that her right leg had crumpled in the wrong direction. When Valia opened her eyes, Carmen saw the blurry tears in them, and she felt awful. Her own eyes filled with tears. "Oh, Valia," Carmen murmured, trying to get a strong hold of her under her arms. "I am so sorry." She heard a little sob escape her own mouth. At once, Carmen saw another pair of arms in the mix. It was the guy she did not yet hate. He was helping her lift Valia from the sticky linoleum. Now the few other patrons gathered around and the counter girl appeared, bouncing nervously from foot to foot. Valia moaned.
"My leg is hurt," she said. "Don't move it, please."
"Okay," Carmen said soothingly. "It's okay.
If you'll just rest your arm over my shoulder, I can support your leg," the guy coaxed her. He got himself in position and nodded to Carmen as if to tell her it was time to lift. She complied. Valia moaned again, but they had her off the floor.
"Valia, the emergency room is right around the corner. We'll take you right there, okay?" Her voice couldn't have been gentler. Valia nodded. The ferocity had abandoned her features for once, and they settled sort of sweetly into her face, even in spite of her obvious pain.
"Ready?" the non-hateful guy mouthed to Carmen. Suddenly, they were partners. They began to walk, Carmen murmuring reassuring things into Valia's ear. On the way out of the shop, Carmen's arms were so occupied she couldn't catch the door as it swung behind her. The sharp edge of the metal doorframe caught her hard on the back of her arm. Carmen did all she could not to stagger or groan. She pressed her lips together and tried not to release the tears loading up her eyes. She noticed that the guy was looking at her. He glanced at her arm. She didn't see the blood until he did. She shrugged a little.
"It's okay," she mouthed over Valia's head.
She vowed not to let her tears go.
In the emergency room, they eased white-faced Valia carefully into a chair. Then Carmen shifted into a mode of pure efficiency. She talked her way to the front of the line, collecting forms she promised to fill out as soon as Valia was in the hands of a doctor. By some miracle, Carmen discovered that one of the emergency room doctors spoke Greek, and before long, Valia was safely, gratefully in an examining room, the Greek words a palliative in her ear. Then Carmen remembered about the non-hateful guy. When she returned to the waiting room, he was still there, elbows resting on knees in a plastic emergency room chair.
"Thank you," she said immediately and earnestly. "That was really, really nice of you."
"Is she okay?" he asked.
"I hope so. There's a doctor who speaks Greek, which made her happy. He seemed to think she might have torn a ligament in a knee, but he didn't think she broke any bones, which is the good news. They're gonna do an x-ray just in case."
It was funny to have all this to say, to have this whole project in common with a guy whose name she did not know. She sat down next to him. He produced a damp paper napkin he'd been holding.
"For you."
He pointed to her arm.
"Oh, God, right."
The blood had stopped flowing and started to dry, but it looked a bit gory nonetheless. She wiped it off with the napkin.
"Thanks."
"Are you okay?"
he asked.
"Totally fine. It's a scratch."
It was more than a scratch, but she liked the feeling of being brave. She looked at the streaky red napkin. He looked at her.
"So, thank you so much. Again," she said quietly.
Carmen wanted to signal to him that he was free to leave, but he didn't appear to want to leave just yet. He was still looking at her, like he was trying to figure something out.
I work here, he offered to the silence.
Really?
Well, volunteer is more accurate. I'm pre-med, so I, you know, want to spend time in the real world of medicine to see if I'm up to it.
I bet you are. Carmen blushed, surprised that she had let that out of her mouth.
Thanks, he said, looking down for the first time.
They were silent for a minute or two. He was wearing brown pumas. He had the goldish sparkle of whiskers on his face like a real grown-up man. His hair had the extra shiny quality of someone who spent a lot of time in a pool. His shoulders were wide, and his torso was strong and lanky, most definitely the build of a swimmer.
Is she your grandmother? He asked.
Oh, Valia? No, she's... Well, she's my... Actually, she's my friend Lena's grandmother. I was bringing her here for some tests. I mean, not the emergency room. That wasn't part of the plan.
Right, he smiled. He was looking at her upper arm again.
Shallowly, she felt pleased that she'd injured a part of her body she felt was particularly good to look at.
Maybe you'll have to come back again for the tests, he said.
I'm sure I'll be back, she said. Valia can't drive here, especially now. And I have a car all to myself right now, and... He nodded. He got up to go.
Maybe I'll get to see you again. I hope so.
Me too, she said faintly, watching him go. She felt her heart streaming into different parts of her body, places she hadn't felt it beat before. And yet, as she went back over the conversation, she felt a trace of apprehension. Valia was her friend Lena's grandmother. Carmen was bringing her for tests. Carmen had a car to herself. Carmen was also getting paid $8.50 an hour. She realized she could have mentioned that too. Hit the point once, then come back and hit it again, then hit it a third time. A tremendous whack. Winston Churchill. Today was a day during which Bridget would almost certainly look upon the face of Eric Richman, and he would look upon hers. It made getting dressed a different project than usual. Usually, she didn't care that much. Or if she did, it was to satisfy her exuberance, like the shiny, shiny pink pants, or her idiosyncrasy, like the pilly green turtleneck everyone hated. This morning, it was more her vanity calling out to be satisfied. Did she want the ponytail high? Nah, too severe. Braids? Carmen looked saucy when she arranged her hair into two braids on the sides, but Bee's pale hair made her look like Heidi. Anyway, how much did she want to use that particular weapon? The hair, as Tibby called it. It had launched 1,000 comments. Cars honked and delivery guys whistled. Even respectable men looked too long. Hairdressers exclaimed over it as though it were a living miracle. The hair. Marley's hair, Greta's hair. In fact, it was nothing more than a bunch of dead cells sprouting out of her scalp, but it was her birthright. Do I want you to notice me? She wondered, leaning so close to the mirror that her eyes formed one large cyclops eye. The mirror in the cramped cabin was speckled with gray and only showed the story from mid-hip to mid-forehead. If she backed up, she'd be sitting in Katie's messy bunk. She shouldn't care about this so much. She felt an annoying buzzing around her head, expectations clustering like so many mosquitoes. She did not like those. She refused to have them. She would just throw on the first pair of shorts she found. And, okay, so they were the really nice short blue Adidas ones. And the first top. Well, the second, because that was the white tank with the racing back, and it looked better than the first one. And the hair? She'd just leave it down. She was not setting a trap. She was not. She was just in a hurry. A coach could not be late. She pulled a hair elastic around her wrist, just in case. She loped out of the cabin barefoot, swinging her cleats by the laces. She'd grown so much, she would probably be taller than Eric in her cleats. Five coaches were already milling around on the center field. One of them happened to be Eric, not that her eyes went there first. Having finally read the camp's handbook in the hour after sunrise when she couldn't sleep, she now knew the deal. The camp was split into girls' and boys' sides.
each side was broken into 6 teams. They played soccer for 4 hours every morning. They put the boys and girls together for speed and agility training for an hour after lunch, and then for the other activities, swimming, water skiing, hiking, rafting, and all kinds of other campish things. After dinner, they had a couple of free hours. Usually there was a movie or something. Now that she'd bothered to look at the roster of coaches, on which Eric Richmond's name did indeed appear in 12-point type, and which had sat folded inside an envelope in her room at home for several weeks, unread, Bridget knew she was assigned to coach a boys' team. That was all right. Diana was coaching one on the girls' side, that was the only negative. They would have had fun together. Bridget sat down in the middle of the field and plucked out the socks she'd balled up in her shoes. She pulled them on and laced up her cleats. She felt the warm sunshine on the top of her head. It's different now. It's all different, she was telling herself, but she was not sure herself was listening. Eric circled close to her with the slightly bemused expression he had often worn around her 2 summers before. She followed him with her eyes. The campers were gathering. They were supposed to all be between the ages of 10 and 14, but the boys particularly were so varied it was almost comical. Some looked like little kids. Some looked nearly like grown men. She saw Manny, assigned to be her trainer, whom she'd met during coaches' meetings the day before. She waved to him and he waved back. The boys' director blew his whistle. Joe Warshaw. He'd played for the San Jose Earthquakes, a major claim to fame. Bridget jumped to her feet, shaking out her legs. This was exciting. She'd coached unofficially in Burgess, Alabama the previous summer. She'd coached at clinics. She'd assisted the JV coach at school a bunch of times. But she'd never coached her own team before. She knew her reputation preceded her. She'd already heard whispering behind her back at breakfast that morning. She was not only the youngest coach, but also the only high school All-American this year. She spent most of her life in places where her soccer accomplishments didn't matter that much. Her friends weren't athletes. They were as supportive as they could possibly be. All 3 of them had cried at her awards ceremony. But they didn't understand what it meant, nor did she really want them to. She loved how much they loved her for everything else. Her dad, always preoccupied, thought being an All-American was basically comparable to making varsity, and her brother had come to a grand total of 1 of her games. But here it was like being a celebrity. These kids worshipped the things she'd accomplished, and Eric, he of all people, knew what it meant. She ended up at Eric's side as the director called out the teams, not entirely on purpose. He was the only one she knew. How strangely she knew him. And it was a perfectly natural place to stand. It's not like I'm going to do that again, she promised herself. Sometimes when she thought of Eric, and now more powerfully when she saw him, she felt some achy nostalgia for her old self, for the dauntless, daring soul she used to be. There was something vaguely enchanted about that time. There were certain qualities you possessed carelessly, and you couldn't retrieve them when they were gone. The very act of caring made them impossible to regain. Not all of that spirit was gone. She still had it, but she had a more tempered version. That time with Eric in Baja had been both the height of that magic and its calamitous end. He had managed to inspire both. She was a bit more fragile now. Or no, maybe she was less fragile. Maybe she had come to terms with her injuries and knew how to protect them. She was more self-protective, that was true. But she was a girl without a mother. She had to protect herself. Bridget had the sense that she was already popular among her constituency. The boys assigned to her made a big thing about it among themselves. As they gathered around her now, some looked boldly admiring and others just looked terrified. She had several capable, well-muscled kids. One of them, a blonde, spoke English with an accent. For some reason, the face that drew her belonged to a broad-faced, freckled, sharp-featured kid with long, gangly legs and extremely large feet. He had a great face, all eagerness, but even just standing still made him look uncoordinated. He was going to be a project, she could tell. While their teams put on their jerseys, Bridget's team was sky blue. She found herself standing near Eric again.
You're popular, aren't you? I've never felt like such a letdown, Eric said laughing, and she was pleased if he meant what she thought he meant.
So, how's it going? She asked him coolly. She wanted him to know she was different now. You look tan.
I just got back from 2 weeks in Mexico.
Bridget felt her face strain. What was he trying to say to her? She'd never been the kind of person who'd overthought people's motives, and she didn't feel like starting now. From his face, he seemed to recognize that he had already shoved them into slightly awkward territory. She cleared her throat. How was it?
He was uncomfortable.
We stayed with my grandmother in Mulegé, and then we traveled down to Los Cabos and ended up in Mexico City for a few days.
Bridget heard one word louder than the others. He was doing that we thing. What was we? Who was we? She wasn't going to stand here wondering. Who is we?
He paused. He wasn't looking at her anymore.
We? Me and Kaya, my girlfriend.
Bridget nodded. His girlfriend, Kaya.
Wow, good for you.
Had he wanted to tell her this? Had he not wanted to tell her?
See you,
Bridget said numbly, walking away to stake a place for her team to gather. She wished she could have blasted those buzzing, swarming expectations with a can of bug spray.
You had hopes, admit it.
She hated dishonesty, especially in herself.
You know you did.
Lena stared out the window of the bus. It was empty, so she pulled her legs up onto the seat and hugged them, loving the feeling of the traveling pants against her skin. It had been a wonderful afternoon of drawing, almost magical. Partly because of wearing the pants, partly because she felt she was really making progress. She pictured the last pose of the day, 20 minutes. She loved the long pose best. They had a new model now, Michelle. She had round hips and long, hyperextending arms. Lena had no thought of assessing the model in terms of beauty. Michelle represented a series of drawing challenges. Lena looked out the window of the bus, but she saw Michelle's elbows. Lena liked her time on the bus and the slow walk from the bus stop to her house in the sweet end-of-day light. It gave her a transition between the meditation of her class and the sharpness of home. This night, she was greeted sharply. Her father was yelling before she could put her bag down.
Where have you been?
He hadn't changed out of his suit yet. He did not look relaxed. She kept her mouth shut. She had a feeling he knew where she hadn't been.
I dropped by the restaurant on my way home from work to say hello, and you were not there, he rumbled.
She shook her head. She felt the dull thud starting in her chest. She would wait to find the extent of his knowledge before trying any damage control.
You don't work the dinner shift, do you?
She shook her head again.
You were at that art class, weren't you?
Was there any point in denying it? There were many stated rules of the pants, but she realized there was an unstated one, too. You couldn't lie in the pants. At least she couldn't. She needed to start breathing again.
Yeah.
His face moved and twitched in anger. His eyes bulged. That was the thing she always dreaded. She and Effie knew that when his eyes went like that, they were in serious trouble. It had happened very rarely throughout their childhood, but in these long months since he'd brought his unwilling mother to live with them, it happened a lot more often. Lena's mother appeared in the front hall behind him. She was distressed.
Let's talk about this in a calm way. George, why don't you change before dinner? Lena, get yourself settled.
She had to pull George away like a coach walking a prize fighter back to his corner. Lena ran upstairs and closed her door. She waited to see if she needed to cry. She endured a couple heaves. A tear soaked into the knee of the pants. Her cheeks were blazing and her pulse was throbbing all around her body. Dinner was a quiet, tense affair. Effie was at a friend's house. Valia's complaints, freshened by her knee injury, actually broke the tension rather than added to it, so thick was the air. At least someone was talking. Afterward, Lena and her mother and father closed themselves up in the den. Her father's anger wasn't as hot, but it seemed to have gotten deeper.
I've done some thinking, Lena.
She was sitting on her hands.
I am deeply troubled that you've lied to us.
Breathe in, breathe out.
You know I've never been happy with the idea of art school for you,
he went on.
It's impractical, it's expensive, and at the end of 4 years you'll have no job prospects. You can't seriously think you'll make a living as an artist.
Lena looked at her mother. She knew Ari was stuck. She didn't disagree with her husband, but she didn't agree with him either.
After seeing that class, I felt it was wrong for you in other ways too. It's not a good atmosphere for a young girl. Some parents may accept that kind of environment for their daughters, but I can't.
At least he wasn't yelling.
I've told your mother this already. I can't support your decision. We will not pay for you to go to RISD. We will pay for a regular university, but we won't pay for that.
Lena was stunned.
Isn't it a little late for this decision?
Her voice sounded raw.
You can find a program, I think. Your grades are good. Some universities are still taking applications. If not, you can apply for next fall and stay home and work to make money.
I'd rather die,
she felt like shouting at him, but she didn't. She said nothing. What could she say? What would matter to him? Certainly not her feelings. He was punishing her for disobeying him. He was dressing up his punishment in clothing of practicality, pretending he was being a good father, but she knew what it was. She pulled her hands out from under her. They felt as cold as marble. Her blood had stopped circulating through her body. She got up slowly and walked out of the room. He wouldn't hear her words. She doubted he'd hear her silence, either.
Patrick.
I'm mad.
SpongeBob. What's the matter, Patrick?
Patrick.
I can't see my forehead.
There was a funny thing about Carmen, and she knew it all too well. She could understand and analyze and predict the exact outcome of her crazy, self-destructive behavior, and then go ahead and do it anyway. It was called premeditation, and it caused people to have to go to jail for their whole lives as opposed to just a few years. What made a person like that? As Carmen once again lay in wait for her tired mother, pretending to flip casually through a magazine in the living room, she was full of guilty premeditation. She kindly waited to pounce, though, until her mom had taken off her shoes and lain down on the living room couch. Now that the truth was out about the baby, Christina's stomach was expanding remarkably.
I got a call from the admissions director of University of Maryland today, Carmen said conversationally, flipping the pages of the magazine a little too fast. The truth was, Carmen wasn't excited about the prospect of spending her freshman year at the University of Maryland. It was a decent school, but it wasn't a fantastic one like Williams. It was huge and anonymous, where Williams was small and personal. What Carmen was excited about, in some perverse way, was telling her mother. Christina was too tired even to express the extent of her confusion.
Why?
Because I applied there, and the admissions lady wanted to tell me they were making a special allowance and letting me in.
Christina tried to sit up a bit.
Nena, I have no idea what you are talking about.
I'm thinking about going to UM instead of Williams.
Now Christina sat the whole way up.
Why in the world would you do that?
Because maybe I'm not ready to leave home just now. Maybe I want to stay and help out and be part of the baby's life.
Carmen tossed this off as though she were describing her plans to get a manicure.
Carmen,
her mother's look was satisfying. She was definitely and certainly paying attention to Carmen's future and nobody else's at this particular moment.
What?
Carmen blinked innocently. Christina inhaled and exhaled yoga style a few times. She settled back onto the cushions and thought a while before she opened her mouth to talk.
Darling, in my selfish heart, I want nothing more than for you to stay home. I hate the thought of you leaving. I'll miss you terribly. You know that. I want you to stay with me and David and the baby. In my selfish heart, that is my fantasy.
Carmen felt tears bulging out of her lids. She'd swung from pure insouciance to tears in under 20 seconds. Christina's voice was soft as she continued. But a good mother doesn't just obey the wishes of her selfish heart. A good mother does what she believes is the best thing for her child. Sometimes they are the same. This time, they are different. Carmen pawed at her cheeks with the back of her hand. What kind of tears were these exactly? Tears of joy? Agony? Fear? Confusion? Maybe a few of each?
How do you know that?
Carmen's voice was full and high with emotion.
How do you know they aren't the same?
Because Williams is the right place for a girl as smart and capable as you, Nena. You belong there.
I belong at home.
You'll always belong at home. Going to Williams doesn't mean you won't belong at home.
Maybe it will, Carmen said.
It won't.
Carmen shrugged and wiped her eyes again with the back of her hand.
I feel like it will.
Lenny, you sounded so sad on the phone earlier, we thought these might cheer you up. The lady at the candy store said she never knew a person who only liked root beer-flavored jelly beans, and to be honest, the all-brown bag doesn't look quite as attractive as the tropical fruit mix, for example. But you are you, Lenny, and we love you like that.
XXXXXXOOOOO.
Tib and Karma. Tibby was outside her window. She was looking up at it, clutching the sill with her hands, feeling the emptiness under her feet. Inside was warm yellow light, and outside, where she was, it was dark. She could feel the apple tree somewhere behind her, but she couldn't see it. Her hands hurt, her arms were lifeless. She wanted to get back into her room so badly. How had she gotten here? Why had she done it? She couldn't drop down into dark emptiness, but she couldn't get back inside either.
Tibby? Tibby?
Tibby opened her eyes and took a moment to orient herself. She was slumped in a movie theater chair. The lights were on. The screen in front of her was blank. Margaret was ever so gently waking her.
Hi, Margaret. Hi. I fell asleep, didn't I?
You did. Don't worry. Your shift is over. I just took care of the garbage for you, so that's all set.
Tibby looked at her gratefully.
Thanks so much. I'll get yours next time, okay?
Groggily, she sat up and let the dream ebb away. She didn't used to fall asleep in movies, but working in a theater could do that to you. Once she'd taken the tickets for the 4 o'clock show and made sure everyone was in their seats and vacuumed the lobby, she was allowed to watch. That was the whole reason she'd asked for Margaret's help to get her this job. But now she'd seen the actress 14 times. The first 3 or 4 were pretty good, but slowly after that, the suspense drained out of the suspense. The spontaneity of the love affair shriveled to nothing. By the 10th or 12th time, Tibby could practically see the gears working in the actors' heads. She could practically see the cheap manipulations of the camera work. By the 14th time, well, she fell asleep. As a lifelong movie lover, it was sad in a way for her to watch the magic of the illusion dry up like a piece of macaroni left overnight in Catherine's booster seat. It made Tibby feel dull and flat, and watching the excitement on the faces of the audience just made her feel worse. She knew that every audience member was taken in by the big, swelling climax with the cellos and violins and gigantic close-ups of earnest, rapturous faces. They felt it was all happening magically and powerfully for them alone. Of course, they didn't consider that they were clutched in the fist of this elaborate fraud. It didn't matter. Tibby had gotten accepted to the film program at NYU on the strength of the movie she'd made about Bailey the summer before. She was about to spend 4 years learning how to make films. She thought it was what she wanted more than anything, but now Tibby was beginning to wonder. She imagined depressingly what it must feel like to be a wedding officiator or a doctor who delivered babies. You'd watch these people in the middle of their personal wonders, imagining for themselves a pure, unique, once-in-a-lifetime experience. And then, an hour or two later, you'd watch somebody else do the same thing. What they thought were miracles were your breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It was sad that what you once thought were marvels on the screen were really manipulations. What you thought was art was just some gimmicky formula. Bridget discussed it with Diana at night after the campers were in bed. They sat on the edge of the lake, tossing rocks into the still water. Bridget outlined her strategy, which was pretty simple. She'd just avoid Eric. She would stay away from him and throw herself into other things, her team, her training, hanging with Diana, and making new friends. And besides, she got 3 weekends off, and so would Eric. Chances were they'd be off on different weekends. It didn't need to matter so much that she and Eric were working at the same camp. It was a big camp. At a pre-breakfast meeting the next morning, the directors gave out assignments to the staff. Besides coaching, they were each assigned partners with whom they would preside over afternoon activities and chaperone certain meals, evening events, and special weekend trips. It was long and somewhat boring, and Bridget tuned it out, surreptitiously glancing at more of the pictures Diana had brought. More Michael, her roommates, her soccer team at Cornell, until she heard her name called.
Vreeland Bridget, rafting and kayaking, 2:30 to 5 weekdays. And you've got Wednesday breakfast, Monday lunch, Thursday dinner, and Sunday night moonlight swim, weekend trips TBA, Joe Warshaw read out.
She shrugged happily. It sounded fun. She didn't know the first thing about rafting or kayaking, but she was a quick learner, and she, more than anyone, loved swimming at night under the stars. Joe was flipping pages on his clipboard.
Vreeland Bridget, you'll partner with...
He was scanning for a name.
Richman Eric.
Joe didn't even look up when he read it. He went on to the next assignment. Bridget hoped she was hallucinating. Diana cast her a panicked look. If Bridget was hallucinating, then so was Diana. It was so outrageous, Bridget almost wanted to laugh. Was this somebody's idea of a joke? Had somebody from Baja phoned ahead to say that Bridget and Eric shared by far the most wrenching history, so be sure to put them together? She looked up and Eric caught her eye. She was frowning.
You can change it, Diana said under her breath. Talk to Joe after. He likes you. He'll change it.
Bridget marched over to Joe after. Hey, can I ask you something?
Sure.
The kitchen staff was beginning to set up for breakfast. Can I, change partners? Would that be all right?
If you give me a good reason.
He seemed to anticipate what she was going to say, because he started back in before she could open her mouth.
And I mean a medical or professional reason. I don't mean a personal reason. I don't accept personal reasons.
Oh. She racked her brain for something that sounded medical or professional. Oozing sores? Would those help? Contagious foot fungus? Multiple personalities? She could make a case for that last one.
Good. Stick with your partner. Everybody always wants to change at first.
He piled up his papers and stood to leave.
You'll do fine.
God is subtle, but not malicious. Albert Einstein. The ferocity was back on Valia's face, and it was more ferocious than ever. They were due in the hospital again, this time for the double whammy of blood testing for Valia's kidneys and physical therapy for her knee. She'd refused to get into the car with Carmen on account of Carmen's allegedly holding the steering wheel wrong. So Carmen was steering Valia down the sidewalk in her wheelchair, much like a mother pushing the stroller of a very grumpy baby. Ashes to ashes, diapers to diapers, strollers to strollers, gums to gums, Carmen mused as she pushed Valia along. Who said she hadn't gotten a babysitting job this summer? There was a reason she was breezing along the 2+ miles to the hospital in the very teeth of the mid-July heat, but she did not yet know his name. And anyway, how much better it was to be outside, sharing Valia with the universe rather than having her in a small, dark room all to herself. With one hand on the wheelchair, Carmen opened her phone with the other hand and pushed the Lena button. Hi, Carmen said when Lena answered. Are you done work?
I have lunch and dinner shifts, Lena said. I'm on break.
Oh.
Listen.
Carmen broke off because Valia had snapped her head around and was scowling, the lines around her mouth deepening.
I don't want to hear you talk on the phone, Valia declared. And how can you push with one hand?
You have to go, Lena said knowingly, sympathetically. Oh, yes, Carmen snapped the phone shut. Ferocity was etching lines on her face, too. One of the advantages of a baby over Valia, say, was that not only were babies considerably cuter, but also they couldn't talk. Carmen pushed the last mile with a clenched jaw. At the hospital, she went first to the kidney floor, number 8. As Valia barked at other non-Carmen people who were trying miserably to help her, Carmen got to roam around in the hallway. In 40 minutes, she saw many faces pass, but not the one she wanted to see. It wasn't until they reached the knee floor, number 3, and Carmen had been prowling that hallway for 20 minutes, that she saw the guy whom she did not yet hate poke his head around the corner. When he saw her, the rest of his body came too. Hey, he said, striding toward her and smiling. God, he could wear a pair of jeans. Had he grown even better looking in the days since she had seen him? Hey, she said back. Her stomach reacted forcefully to the sight of him. I realized I forgot to ask you your name last time, he said. I've been wondering for a week. Did you come up with any ideas? Carmen asked. He thought. Florence? She shook her head. Rapunzel? Nope. Angela? She squinched up her nose in displeasure. She had a very fat second cousin named Angela. Okay, what? He asked. Carmen. Carmen. Okay. He tilted his head, fitting her to her name. What about you? My name is Wynne. He said it sort of loud, as though he were expecting an argument. Carmen narrowed her eyes. Wynne? As opposed to lose? Wynne, as opposed to... He had a slightly pained look on his face. Winthrop. Winthrop? She smiled. Had she known him long enough to tease him? I know, he winced. It's a family name. I hated it from the beginning, but I didn't learn to talk till I was 2, and by that time it had stuck. She laughed. Why do we let other people name us? Yeah, he said indignantly. Why? Somebody should change that. I remember that skier in the Olympics, Carmen recalled. Her parents let her name herself, and I'm pretty sure she chose Peekaboo. He nodded sagely. Well, yeah, there is that. She smiled. Win. Huh. Win, 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 win. She didn't mind at all. How's your... He pointed to her arm. Not coincidentally, she was wearing her most flattering sleeveless shirt, which offered a long view of her tanned, curvy upper arm. Both of her arms, actually. It's fine. Practically all better.
Good. How's Valia doing? Ligament, right? Anterior cruciate?
She nodded happily. Carmen's main problem with guys was that she had nothing to say to them. She loved the fact that she and Wynne, had all these things to talk about, even though they didn't know each other.
Carmen? Carmen!
It was the sound that chilled her blood, that dried her bones and made her lunch crawl back up her throat. Carmen tried to keep her face bright. That would be Valia. She needs me. I better go.
She doesn't sound happy, Wynne observed.
Well, Carmen bit her lip. She didn't want to vent her suffering to Wynne. It just seemed wrong here. Valia's had a rough time. She dropped her voice to a low volume. She lost her husband less than a year ago, and she had to move here from the beautiful island in Greece where she was born and spent her entire life, and... Carmen felt genuinely sad for Valia as she described it. She's just really... sad. Wynne looked solemn.
That does sound rough.
Yeah, I better go, Carmen said. She wasn't sure she could endure the Valia wail another time.
She's lucky about one thing, though. Wynne called after her.
Carmen turned her head as she walked away, feeling her long hair swing over her shoulder like a girl in a movie. What's that?
She has you.
Lena felt too fragile to go back to drawing class for a few days. She knew her father would be watching her closely now. She waited until she felt strong enough for a confrontation before she dared to go back. She asked Anik if they could talk during the long break, and Anik agreed. This time Lena led the way to the courtyard. Anik had been so pleased when Lena had first told her about Rizdi. Anik rattled on about all the teachers she knew there. Now, with the change in plans, Lena felt like she had to tell her that too.
"So he says I can't go. They won't pay for it," Lena explained numbly.
Anik's mouth narrowed. Her dark eyes widened within their frames of reddish eyelashes. She seemed to hold back. She probably knew it didn't help to trash a person's parent, no matter what he'd done.
"He says you can't go or he won't pay for it?" she asked finally, flatly. "I guess both. I can't go if they don't pay."
"Are you sure about that?"
Lena shrugged. "I hadn't really thought about it."
"You should. People go to art school who don't have any money. There are two ways. I'm guessing that you wouldn't qualify for financial aid." Lena shook her head. They lived in a big, nice house with a pool. Her father was a successful lawyer. Her mother had a good income.
"Then you'll have to win a merit scholarship," Anik said. "How do you do that?"
Lena was afraid to be hopeful. "I could call my friend..." Anik stopped herself. She put her hands together. Lena counted Anik's rings, 9 altogether. "If I were you," Anik went on, changing course, "I'd go on the website or call them up and find out. And if they tell you no, then ask some more questions until you get somebody to tell you yes." Lena looked doubtful.
"I'm not really good at that kind of thing."
Anik looked impatient, not mad or dismissive, but definitely impatient. "Do you want to go to art school or stay home?"
"I want to go to art school. I can't stay home."
"Then figure out how to do it." Anik put her hand briefly on Lena's elbow.
"Lena, I think you could do something good. I think you have talent, possibly a lot of it, and I don't say that lightly. I want you to try. I can see it's what you love, but I can't fight for you. You have to fight for yourself."
"I do?"
Anik gave Lena an encouraging half-smile. "You do. You've got to take up some space, girl." So the first strategy wasn't going to work. Not only was Bridget not going to avoid Eric, she was going to see him constantly. Somebody up there was having a sick laugh at her expense. Bridget took a long run on her break after lunch and tried to formulate Plan B. She and Eric weren't going to be strangers, so they were going to have to be friends. She could do that. She could treat him like a regular guy, couldn't she? She could try to forget that he was her first and her only. She could put aside the disastrous effect their brief fling had on her life. She could ignore, she could try really hard to ignore, the mighty attraction she felt to him. She could make herself accept that he did not feel that same attraction for her. Bridget was breathing hard now, running up a steep hill, curving round and round. The forest cosseted her on either side. The truth was, she had never felt so overwhelmingly drawn to anyone. In the 2 years since they'd seen each other, she had questioned this particular magnetism Eric had for her. Was it real? Or was she so caught up in a mania of her own making that summer in Baja that she had imagined it? Seeing him again this summer answered her question. It was real. She responded to him the same way, even though she was different. What was it about Eric? He was handsome and talented, yeah, but lots of guys were. She had adored Billy Klein back in Alabama the summer before, and she had even felt attracted to him, but it wasn't like this. What made you feel that stomach-churning agony for one person and not another? If Bridget were God, she would have made it against the law for you to feel that way about someone without them having to feel it for you right back. Bridget reached the top of the little mountain. Suddenly the trees fell away and she could see furrowed hills and steamy valleys on and on. The camp, in which all of this agitation was contained, was small and circular. From this height, it was small enough to put her arms around. Bridget knew what to do. She couldn't control her basic response to Eric, but she could control her behavior. She had been tough and single-minded then, and she was now too. Just as she'd found a way to seduce him back then, she could find a way not to do it now. She had a weekend at home coming up. She would pull herself together. And when she got back to camp, she would contain herself. She wouldn't flirt, she wouldn't tempt, she wouldn't pine, she wouldn't grieve, she wouldn't even yearn. Well, maybe she'd yearn a little, but she'd keep it to herself. She began the run downhill, fast and just a little bit out of control. Yes, they would be friends. They would be pals. He would never know what she really felt. It was going to be a very long summer.
Can I buy you a drink, or should I just give you the money? Failed pickup artist.
Come on, Tibby, we're going. Tibby was standing in the front door of her house, watching Bee jump up and down on the lawn and shout at her. Her yellow head radiated light in the darkness.
Where are we going? Tibby asked flatly.
It's a surprise. It'll be fun. Come on. Tibby walked out onto the summer lawn, feeling the bits of mown grass sticking to her bare feet.
I don't want a surprise. I don't want to have fun.
That's exactly why you need some. Carmen was at the wheel of her car, honking the horn and waving out the window. Tibby could see Lena in the front passenger seat. Bee came close and bent her head toward Tibby's.
Come on, Tib. Catherine is bouncing back like a little super ball. You're allowed to feel okay, you know.
I have one night before I go back to Pennsylvania. I'm not spending it without you. Tibby ran back to the house to tell her parents she was going. Usually, her parents went out on Saturday nights, but since Catherine's accident, they stayed close to home. And besides, since they'd fired Loretta, who was going to cover for them? Tibby trudged to Carmen's car without bothering to get shoes.
I don't want to go, she announced to the group once inside the car.
You don't even know where we're going, Lena pointed out.
I still don't want to go.
Carmen released the brake and drove off anyway.
The lucky thing for you, Tibby, is that your friends don't listen to you.
Tibby shook her head humorlessly.
I don't really see how that's lucky.
Because we love you too much to let you fester in your room for the rest of the summer, Carmen clarified.
Fester was her word of the week.
Maybe I like to fester, Tibby said.
But festering does not like you, Carmen nodded decisively, as though this were the last word on the subject.
Tibby sat back and let the comfortable nattering swirl around her. Listening to her friends' voices felt like hearing a familiar symphony, with one instrument coming in and layering atop another. The way the cadences linked and harmonized made her feel safe. Until Carmen pulled into the parking lot of the Rockwood pool.
Why are we here?
We're going swimming, Bee offered.
Why don't we just go to Lenny's? Tibby asked.
Her parents are home, and Valia is asleep, Carmen explained.
Enough said. No sane person wanted to wake up Valia, and her bedroom window faced the back of the house.
Well, this pool is closed.
Tibby felt sour as she said it.
Just come on, okay? Bee said.
Tibby followed them over the bridge of the piddling creek that used to seem to her like a roaring waterway connecting parts unknown. It was probably just for sewage. She followed them up the endless steep stairs that used to seem to her like the stairway to heaven. They approached the locked gates, then fanned out to the sides. Tibby was starting to get an even worse feeling about this.
This is the place, Bee called out, pointing up at the one part of the fence not spangled by razor wire.
Bee was already climbing by the time they'd gathered at the foot of it.
Up and over, she called gaily, making it look as simple as mounting a bike.
I'm not coming, Tibby said.
Why not?
Carmen and Lena both turned to look at her.
This was the kind of stunt she would normally have gone along with.
but the thought of climbing the fence made Tibby feel almost physically sick. She couldn't explain all the reasons, but she knew she wasn't doing it.
I just don't feel like it, she said.
Bee paused on the other side of the fence. They were all obviously disappointed that they couldn't get Tibby excited about their plan. Bee reversed her climb. Now Tibby felt bad.
But you guys go ahead, she said, trying to lighten her voice. Seriously, go. I don't mind. Besides, you need someone to stand guard here. You know, like, just in case.
It sounded pitiful to Tibby's own ears.
I wish you'd come. It won't be as fun without you, Lena said.
Next time, Tibby answered, feeling like a big loser. So, there she sat, slumped against the side of the fence, the outside, the wrong side, pretending she was standing guard, while she listened to her friends strip down to their underwear and splash into the water. They were more subdued than they would have been if Tibby had gone along, but still, they were willing to play.
Karma, I will pay you back, I swear.
Carmen rolled her eyes.
Shut up. Why are you saying that? We don't pay each other back. We're not keeping score.
Tibby actually paused from her insane flurry of activity to look appreciatively at Carmen.
So, I won't pay you back.
Thank God. Carmen took a tube of cherry-flavored Blistex from the mess of stuff on Tibby's dresser and put some on.
11th floor, right?
Yeah, check in at reception. Ask for Dr. Barnes. There's a little kid's lounge in case you have to wait.
No problemo. It's my home away from home.
Carmen held up Tibby's soft, charcoal t-shirt and considered stealing it.
Catherine's going to be very happy about this.
Carmen returned the shirt to the mess.
And it's good practice for me, right?
Her voice had turned sober. Tibby sensed her mood and touched her wrist. I think you already got it down, Karma. Carmen led the way to the foot of the stairs, where Catherine was waiting eagerly, her yellow backpack strapped over both shoulders, her hockey helmet tipped at a slightly rakish angle.
You ready, baby?
Catherine stood up on her kitchen chair and, with no regard for her caste, put her arms up in a point like a diver. She jumped to Carmen. Tibby helped her load Catherine into the baby seat they'd fastened into Carmen's car and hopped into the co-pilot seat. First, Carmen dropped Tibby off at work, and then she drove to the hospital. As they parked, Carmen enjoyed the good spirits of Catherine, chirping away from the back seat, never complaining once about her driving, in contrast to, say, Valia. As they whooshed through the automatic doors into the giant lobby, Carmen lifted Catherine into her arms. Sweetly, Catherine clung to her like a koala, her hockey helmet wobbling just under Carmen's chin.
Can I push the button?
She asked in the elevator.
Yes, 11. 1-1.
Carmen steered Catherine's index finger in the right direction. Her excitement over this made Carmen feel as though she'd just awarded Catherine a lifetime of good fortune.
Nikki always gets to push,
Catherine explained, pushing several extra times. Carmen couldn't keep her eyes from scanning the halls. Her heart was beating a lot harder and faster than normal. Of course she was thinking about him. Of course she wanted to see him. But, on the other hand, she didn't. She rested Catherine on the reception counter in pediatrics.
Catherine Rollins to see Dr. Barnes? She said to the woman behind the desk.
The woman wrote Catherine's name down and located her file.
Do you want to play in the playroom for a few minutes, sweetie? She asked Catherine.
Can she come?
Catherine touched her pointing finger right to Carmen's cheekbone.
Of course, the woman said, and gestured them in the right direction.
Carmen couldn't help looking over her shoulder as she walked. A part of her really wanted to see him, a big part.
Well, another time, she thought, entering the confines of the playroom.
It was bright and sunny, involving a few other children and lots of toys and miniature furniture. Carmen would have to content herself with standing or sitting on the floor, because there was no way she was fitting into an Elmo chair. And if by some miracle she did fit in, she wouldn't be getting out. She pictured herself walking out of the hospital with a red plastic Elmo chair attached to her butt.
Hey, you.
She put Catherine down in front of a bead maze and straightened her helmet.
What do you want to play? Catherine danced around, utterly pleased. She brought over a Noah's Ark, a xylophone, two puppets, and a book. Carmen knew that Catherine was always miffed at how Tibby's friends came over and spent time with Tibby. Now she had Carmen all to herself. Carmen heard a girl's giggle from behind the big dollhouse set up in the corner. She also saw a few parts of a man popping out, the girl's father, no doubt. Carmen figured she and Catherine could take over the dollhouse once those two vacated. Twin boys were throwing Nerf basketballs at each other. Carmen observed that somebody had taken a few bites out of one of the balls.
How about this?
Catherine was shaking the animals out of the ark. They played. There were a lot of singletons in this version of Noah's story, probably due to loss and theft, but Catherine didn't seem to care. Carmen was the hippo, the elephant, the lion, and the penguin. It was good because Carmen had always had a knack for animal sounds and voices. With the penguins, she really got into a character. In this case, her penguin was a mafioso, kind of like Marlon Brando in The Godfather, only in a penguin-y way. Catherine was laughing so hard she stopped making any noise. The people behind the dollhouse were laughing too. The twin boys were circling them eagerly. Suddenly, Carmen realized that the leg extending from one side of the dollhouse had a brown shoe on the end of it. A brown puma, specifically. She cut off the penguin's soliloquy. Moments later, a face appeared over a miniature gable. She put both hands over her eyes in complete humiliation. Hi, Wynn. Could she have been any louder? He came entirely out from behind the dollhouse. He was fighting the impulse to smile. No, probably the impulse to laugh. At her. Hi, Carmen, he said. He crawled over to where she was sitting, cross-legged on the floor. He pushed the inner part of her elbow and made the arm she was leaning on collapse. Can I tell you, I've never heard a more entertaining penguin in my life. I didn't even know penguins could talk. Ha ha, Carmen said, straightening her arm again. She tried to pull herself up and recapture some tiny amount of dignity. She cleared her throat. Wynn, this is Catherine. Catherine and I are friends. Catherine, this is Wynn. Catherine stood up somewhat importantly.
Hi,
she said. Wynn pointed to her helmet. I like your stickers. She nodded.
I crushed my skull.
Carmen looked aghast. You didn't crush your skull, sweetie. You fractured it. Catherine waved this off as an uninteresting detail. And it's getting better really fast, Carmen added, possibly for her own sake.